Welcome to the inaugural podcast episode of UN House Scotland's new podcast series, Connecting Women's Voices on Climate Justice, Perspectives from Scotland and Around the World. My name is Katrina Spavin-Don. As well as working on climate and gender at UN House, I also work with an environmental nonprofit on sexual and reproductive rights and women's empowerment. And I'm currently launching a nature education and agroecology project with Maya Ishil Youth in rural Guatemala. On behalf of the climate and gender team at UN House, I am delighted to be sharing virtual space with our two speakers today. I'm excited to dive into what promises to be a very galvanizing and thought-provoking conversation around climate and gender justice. Like our two speakers, I have seen firsthand that the worst impacts of the climate crisis are felt by the most vulnerable communities who live at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities, such as Indigenous and racialized women. Friends of the Earth define climate justice as addressing the climate crisis while also making progress towards equity and the protection and realization of human rights. Today, we're going to speak about what this means and how we can achieve it with Isadora Cardoso and Mae East. Isadora is a queer feminist climate activist and expert. She is currently a fellow of the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies in Potsdam, Germany. Isadora works with and studies intersectional perspectives and solutions to the climate crisis. She holds a master's degree in globalization and development studies and has been working on and researching gender and climate issues over the past 5 years. She's worked with collectives focusing on gender and climate justice in Brazil, Germany, the Netherlands, and internationally. We are also welcoming Mae East, a sustainability educator, spatial planner, and social innovator. Her work spans the fields of cultural geography, urban ecology, and women's studies. Designated one of the 100 global sustainability leaders 3 years in a row, she currently works in 55 countries with community-based organizations and intergovernmental agencies in policy guidance for SDG implementation, with projects seeking to strengthen climate resilience, food security, and women's empowerment. Welcome to you both, and thank you so much for joining us in this very first episode of Connecting Women's Voices at the Intersection, Gender, Climate, and Regenerative Futures. Hello.
Hi, Catriona. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to this conversation.
So am I. So I want to start by referencing a project that Isadora, you were recently part of, Not Without Us, Climate Justice and Gender Justice in International Climate Politics. I'm interested in this phrase, nothing about us without us. And no, it was initially popularized in the disability rights movement. So can you talk to us about what this means and why it's important in the context of climate and gender justice?
Yes, sure. Thank you, Kat, for the introduction. And I will start by answering that this project, which I was a part of since until April this year, it was part of my work in an NGO based in Berlin in Germany called Gender CC Women for Climate Justice. In this project, we used to work with Global South grassroots activists, climate and gender justice activists who were fighting for climate justice in their own countries. So we had participants from different countries in Indonesia, South Africa, Ecuador, and we have produced a lot of knowledge and also materials together throughout the years where we worked. And the idea behind the name of the group is which is inspired indeed in the disabilities movement since some years, is that there is no, and it is a matter of justice to include the people who are most hit by the issues that we are working on, in regardless of what it is. And so it is, when we talk about climate justice or gender justice, you cannot talk about climate justice without considering the needs and the and what the people on the front lines of climate impacts or the climate, the projects which are impacting the climate the most, extractive, for example, industries or mining in mining regions. So all these local communities, indigenous communities, for example, or rural communities, which are really at the front line, realizing the direct impacts of this massive destructions, they are the ones which should be actually mostly included and heard whenever we want to decide on the actions to counter all the damage which was already done and which is still being done, but trying to make them less harmful, especially for these most marginalized and impacted communities. So the idea behind it is that is the idea of justice in itself, that the groups which are the ones receiving or more impacted by whatever is in the topic, they should be the ones heard and the ones empowered to heard, or even given the means to take part in the in those topics, in those decisions, in all the actions that should be that are actually being taken to counter, for example, in this case, climate change. And I could talk more about what we did in this project, which was basically we would connect among ourselves, like activists from different parts of the world, share our local concerns and what were the contexts where we worked, what were the main issues going on, for example, environmental issues that were happening. And by learning from each other, we would try to learn how to influence policymaking at the international level, at the climate negotiations. And also by bringing us there, it would be also a means to make these spaces more representative and also more diverse, since we were these people, like, you know, indigenous peoples are still not really bigly represented in those spaces. So in brief, that is the idea. It's the justice idea behind this name, indeed. Mm.
And exactly that networking and the connecting of women's voices is also what we're hoping to do with this podcast series, in bringing together different strategies and common goals as well across the world. So May, you state that one of your passions is to design learning trajectories supporting Indigenous and migrant communities and their traditions to survive in rapidly changing environments. Can you talk to us a bit about some of your experiences working with these different communities, Indigenous and migrant women, and perhaps also explain a bit about a concept that you've developed called presency, which I'm very interested in. This is, I believe, the concept of a combination of women's presence and agency.
Yes, thank you, Kat. So I would say that in a resource-constrained world, our programs aim to unlock the potential of women to lead their communities in adapting to the impacts of the climate change while addressing, I would say, the convergence of multiple crises that include the socioeconomic and environmental ecological degradation. So at the center of our project-based learning, PBLs, are women from climate vulnerable global South communities, either facing these multiple crises within their settlements, including erratic weather, food scarcity, ecosystem degeneration, and loss of livelihood, or those women who have endured traumatic journeys to the global north due to the impossibility of safety and livelihood back home. So we work with migrant women arriving in the global north and global south women to survive and to thrive in the context of the convergence of multiple crises. So we adopt very much a participatory approach and a whole systems design approach. The whole systems design springs from Gaia Education eco-village mindset that talks about redesigning our human presence in terms of social design, ecological, economic, and worldview, but also we adopt a participatory approach inspired and favoring Paulo Freire's invigorating critique of the banking model of capacity building, challenging the perception of women as mere as receivers of technical support devoid of creative impetus. So in practical terms, we bring together women to strengthen their leadership, community building, communications capacities, and transform their social status by leading their community to sustainable livelihoods through regenerative agriculture and cooperative enterprises. So we strengthen the advocacy, the communication skills at the same time that we support bringing back life and productivity to the land upon which they depend. by testing a number of agricultural scenarios for the regeneration of their natural assets. And we use very much cutting edge permacultural and agroforestry approaches. They learn very much the concept of conscious design and using locally relevant components of sustainable food production, including mixed cropping, nitrogen fixation, biofertilizers, seed bank development. They start to mimic the diversity, stability, and resilience of ecosystems. So something starts happening to their deserted lands, and slowly they, you know, with the social skills, advocacy skills, and also witnessing some of these techniques starting to bring life and into their systems, the next stage of the learning journey is about harnessing the social enterprise tools for maximizing the potential of the yields, and by adding value to their produce and helping to support developing national or local, national and international markets for their products as well. So we're talking about a social, ecological, economic design done in a way that they are designers of the future they want to create, more than we are those who know and come and share with them the new techniques. So together we learn together. Actually, most of the time I learn more in the PBLs and the project-based learnings than those that are working with us.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting to hear about these multiple strategies which are so rooted in the earth, and thinking about the power of relocalizing and horizontalizing and creating that, you know, shorter supply chain so that the producers and the consumers are not so far removed as well. And you mentioned Gaia Education, so it might be interesting to hear a little more about your journey with Gaia Education and the establishment of the organization through the Global Ecovillage Educators for a Sustainable Earth. You've talked about some of these, you know, very practical strategies to think about the vision of Gaia, which is a resilient future within planetary boundaries in which no one is left behind. I think that last part is really key as well. So could you tell us a bit about how this came to be and how you found yourself on this journey?
Yes, sure. Gaia Education was born of an exercise, an experiment between 23 eco-village educators. We were all living in those laboratories for sustainable living. I was at that stage living in Finhorn, eco-village in the northeast of Scotland. And we met over 8 years. And we were all educators in our own eco-village, designers for sustainability. Some of us were educators, economists, food producers, and together over 8 years, we created this, what we call the whole systems design approach of how to use a systems perspective for systems change that could be replicated in other contexts beyond eco-villages. So Gaia Education was very much founded at the same time that the world was setting this notion of education for sustainable development, and was very interesting because together with the ESD and Gaia Education, we kind of we journeyed together over the last 15 years. And of course, at that stage, we're talking about design for sustainability. And then suddenly we realized that to still hold this paradigm of sustainability, now that the whole world has caught up with us with SDGs, was not enough, because many of the systems that we are working, they have been so much disrupted by the human presence that there's nothing to sustain. We need to start bringing more life into the system. So therefore we start working with the concept of regeneration that we can talk later in this conversation. So basically Gaia Education was born out of a eco-village movement, these laboratories of sustainable living, where we are testing many hypotheses, but at the same time, some things that work well, we then, you know, abstract the learning and turn into educational programs.
Great. It's, as a participant in one of Gaia Education's courses, I am just, you know, my whole perspective on the land around us and our place within it and of it has really changed and developed. So I know that you're doing really important and impactful work on the ground. Isadora, I'm keen to hear how the vision that we've talked about set up and now being developed by Gaia Education of this resilient future within planetary boundaries, and especially in which no one is left behind, resonates for you and your current work that you are doing with the Institute for Advanced Sustainability Studies in Potsdam.
Okay, I think it's also very interesting knowing now a bit more about this idea of resilient futures from the Gaia Education. I can speak about a little bit of what I am interested in, what I'm going to develop in this current work, and also like saying that this institute is a very multidisciplinary place where people from humanities, so social scientists, arts, also natural scientists, they come together and they talk about sustainability studies. But I've seen quite interesting and, let's say, progressive research being done there, and also very, I would say, experimental projects in this 1 month of work that I'm doing already there. So it's quite recent for me. I'm still like getting to know, but it's very it sounds very interesting. As for my work, I am interested in, I think it resonates. So I'm basically interested in knowing what are the groups, the local groups in Brazil and also in Germany working for and demanding that energy transition from fossil fuels to renewable energies would look like, but centering in the matter of justice. So I'm interested in knowing what are the groups working on just transition, which is a term that is already widely used in many contexts, including the international negotiations. We do talk about just transition, which is a transition from a context of dependency on fossil and dirty energies to a context of clean or renewable energies, but in a just way, in a way that would not increase inequalities and but also give benefits to the most marginalized and most impacted communities again. So I'm centering again in the matter of justice, and I would like to center also and have like a more intersectional approach when I look at what those groups are working on the ground and how are they pushing for just when they talk about just energy transition in this different context of Brazil and Germany. And so I think what this concept resonates in my project is that it is actually, these groups are, many of these groups working on these issues, I can talk already. They are groups of, you know, workers. They're groups of workers who have been mining, like have worked sometimes in mining industries, but they are like from socially disadvantaged classes. They can be also groups or rural groups, rural communities or traditional communities like indigenous groups, which are impacted by some energy industries. So these groups, they have been creating alternatives, sustainable alternatives locally for a future which is not dependent on, you know, all those dirty energy industries that we have. So I think I am interested in this because we know that the solutions already exist, and there have been like indigenous peoples and especially indigenous peoples, they have been using and surviving and resisting using these alternatives to for centuries. So I think this is a part of my interest, and it can be something really that now when I look from this perspective of Gaia Education, I think it's a bit similar.
Mm. And I mean, you know, cleaner renewable energy in Germany is very well publicized, and it must be interesting to be comparing that with what's going on at home for you in Brazil. And so maybe you could now, you know, take this opportunity to tell us a wee bit more about that, and especially thinking about, you know, the added challenges of the current government, the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, you mentioned just transition, and I know that as you say, there's multiple contexts for the way in which we can have that transition rooted in justice. And one of those is coming out of this pandemic. You know, what does a new normal look like, and how do we create that? So I imagine that these conversations are very divergent in Germany and in Brazil. What are you currently finding on that?
So as I said, it's like I have just started this project, and but I can already anticipate. I have some hypotheses already. As you said, the contexts are very different, not only because of the governments we have. Like, one government is at least taking the climate crisis as a thing, and the other is denying it firmly. And even working like to benefit still the big corporations, or denying even like the corona crisis, right? And so I think this is already a huge difference, which would really impact my observations. But again, when I look at the, when I say that I'm interested in knowing what are the groups, the local groups, the local, you know, civil society organizations, the local social movements, what are they working already for years in terms of justice, environmental justice or climate justice, is that I think that I can anticipate that I will find like a lot of this difference, but also rooted in this the different historical context and also geographical context that we have, but especially that they are actually, many of them, they bring you know, they always bring the issues that the sustainability, that, for example, in Brazil, sustainability is something that is maybe invented or practiced more in the last 50 years, but it's been something that has been practiced for ever since the beginning of the colonization by indigenous peoples in Brazil. So it's something about really acknowledging the solutions that that are already there, and that somehow we were alienated from in this colonial and capitalist system. So I think that's more or less, I don't know if I answered your question correctly, but you can ask me more.
Yeah. I'm thinking about the recent Global Gathering for Climate Justice from the Ground Up, and a speaker representing the International Network of Decoloniality and Autonomy, who was speaking about community solutions to territorial destruction alongside a number of indigenous speakers from the Amazon region, whether it be Peru or Brazil. And he said, there are strategies in indigenous communities that have been used, as you say, for thousands of years increase and strengthen our resilience, but the ways that these reduce emissions, or, you know, have a holistic source, are not just within indigenous communities. Community solutions can take place across the world in urban contexts and different rural contexts, you know, in Fintorn, for example, and having that strengthening of the local, which I think, you know, also grounds us again in the earth and what we can do to strengthen our food sovereignty and our food security, and shorten those supply chains, as I mentioned before. So it will be interesting, I think, for you to explore these ideas further and have these two case studies that do have just such different realities at the moment.
Definitely. And I will, for sure, I will take, I will go back into the Global Gathering of the from the Ground Up, because I think there's so many interesting groups, especially grassroots groups from around the globe, who were bringing amazing points, like just what you said. Thank you for the tip.
You know, it's really exciting to see that these imperative conversations are happening, and obviously Scotland this year is one of the key locations for these conversations, given that COP26 will be happening in November in Glasgow. Maybe before we talk a little bit more about that, I'm interested in this dynamic of, you know, the grassroots and strategy community-based solutions, community-led solutions as well, community-driven solutions. And at UN House here in Scotland, we look to promote the goals and values of the UN at this grassroots level. So through community outreach, through public engagement, and engagement with the parliament. So I'm interested that Isadora, you've previously worked with the UNDP in Brasilia, and May, you're a UNITAR fellow and have worked extensively on the SDGs. So maybe you can tell us, May, about this work on the SDGs and your perceptions of what still needs to be done. In relation to this podcast, we are, I guess, specifically thinking about SDGs 5 and 13, gender equality and climate action.
Yes, I think when we start working with SDGs on the ground, it's very important that we take this perspective of policy resources and practice. Because if you, for instance, you start looking, and first of all, let's say that SDG for me is a framework, it's not a goal. It's a framework for us to start looking at how are we redesigning our human presence in our communities. So it helps us to have a lexicon, a way of explaining what is already emerging. It's not that our communities are going to be following what the UN is saying. It's just like a framework in a way of narrating what's already happening on the ground. Mm-hmm. And in this context, I would say that when you start looking at the SDGs again, we cannot be, you know, chopping the reality in 17 pieces in order. We have to start working at the interdependencies between the goals. Mm-hmm. And it's great that our conversation today is connecting 5 to 13 women and climate change. But I would say from my perspective, it also connects with many other ones, because for me, climate change and women can only be resolved as equation. Can only bring regeneration if we look at ecosystems, new economic, if we talk about empowerment, if we talk about education. So everything is connected. But when everything is connected and we're looking at the interdependencies, because by looking at the interdependencies, that's where innovation can emerge. I would say that in my experience on the ground with communities, you need to look at three levels at the same time: policy, resources, and practice. Sometimes you go to a place and there's already lots of examples how that SDG is already working, but it reaches a glass ceiling because there is not enough resources or there's no policy to help. And sometimes SDGs have very strong policies, but they don't have resources to implement. So the way for us to analyze how to bring this framework to really unleash the power of sustainability in that specific community, you need to analyze and try to create a symbiotic relationship between, yes, we need policies, we could policies guide. We need to resource those policies, and those policies and resources need to be based upon what is already emerging from the community. So once you look to this trifocal lens, I see potential of this framework really speeding up the process of the redesign of our human presence in our territories. But sometimes you have only policies and nothing happens, or sometimes you have only grassroots and you can't do more than what you're already doing. So combining the three is really important.
Yeah, that's so interesting to really consider that those three are, as you say, totally intertwined, and that you can't really achieve one without the other or work through one without the other. And I think that, you know, looking ahead to COP, then the policies might be there, but who's making the policies? And then we come back to this point of nothing about us without us, and really making sure that those who are most affected are also those who have their voices heard and listened to in the process of policy making. And historically, that hasn't been the case at COP, has it? Because less than a quarter of delegation heads are women, and many of those women who are represented come from the global north. And we know from recent research that 80% of those displaced by climate change are women, as well as, you know, beyond displacement, many of the other impacts that come along with this crisis, which is worsening by the day. So why does this discrepancy exist? That's a big question. This goes to kind of, you know, the heart of gender inequalities across the world. But, you know, we know that policies can make a difference. We know that we have to be informed by practice, and we've got to support the resources in order for it to get off the ground and have that impact. So how do we make these changes? How do we get women and girls involved so that they are key to climate solutions involving these three interconnected processes?
I could also try, if May is, are you? Sorry, I don't want to interrupt.
No, go with Dara, go for it.
Okay, because I was just thinking about, you know, we have this resource and I also look at it as a framework. So there is this plan, the Gender Action Plan, which was adopted by the UN, so the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, in 2017 for the first time, and then it was renewed again in Madrid in 2019. And so we have a framework at the international level, which is really pushing now for, you know, not only gender balance in the negotiations on climate change, and the international level, but also more resources, more capacity building, so that women, especially indigenous women, women from, they call it local communities. So women from more marginalized and impacted communities by climate change, so that they can have the needed resources to take part actively in those decision-making spaces, and that their voices are heard. So there is this mechanism already since 2017, but indeed there are no resources, as May was saying. So, well, at least not so many, not the necessary ones to really fill in the gap, this big gap which was caused. So if we talk about the causes of such a discrepancy, it would be like, okay, let's start with, you know, colonization or like the start of the times. But so there's always the systemic approach, right? But anyways, talking about this currently, I think indeed there are already like quite some structured plans to fill in those gaps. What we need more is finance for really make those plans happen, and also especially commitments from Global North countries, which were historically more responsible for this discrepancy around the world and for climate change in itself. And so more commitment from global North countries is a matter of justice also, including I would say resources, like financial resources especially. And yeah, I will stop there. I could say much more, but I'll stop.
I want to add a few things to Isadora thinking, because I think that when we talk about resources, it's not only finances from my perspective. It's very much SDG 17, which is the means of implementation, that we learned a lesson of the 90s with incredible agendas, Agenda 21, Agenda Habitat, the social agenda, and having these very lofty aspirations and not having the means of implementation. And then coming to the SDGs, okay, there are going to be two SDGs. One is about strong institutions, SDG 16, without strong and transparent governance and institutions, and without means of implementation, all those other goals will not get anywhere. It's like rearranging the chairs of the Titanic, one more convention, you know, and here we are, you know, our presence impacting more and more life systems on the planet. So I would say that sometimes the resources is about markets. I'll give you two examples. Like I've been working with a Federation of Tribal Women in Orissa, about 17,000 women, and they produced turmeric, which is a very, has been discovered in the West as anti-cancer and this and that. So we've been able to create supply chains and open markets for them to sell organic turmeric, paid international fees, and also help them to place their turmeric in national markets in India. Another example is that a project that I've been involved for the last 3 years, supported by the Scottish government in Zambia, called Zikala, Zambian Youth and Conservation Agriculture, Sustainable Livelihoods Action. And we were able to establish a supply chain with Lush Cosmetics. So now, first of all, we have introduced beekeeping for girls, which is normally, traditionally, beekeeping, it is a part of a profession for only men in the in this central province of Zambia. And we slowly, we noticed the great capacity of beekeeping in this Miombo woodlands ecosystem where these communities are. And we brought beekeeping, and they start to develop their skills, and then we start selling to their local markets, their national markets, and now we're doing the first export to Lush. So sometimes it's not only the cash, but really is providing the partnership needed with ethical buyers in the global north that pay the price that is ethically, you know, considered. So resources sometimes is beyond finances. It's finances as well, but sometimes it's about partnerships.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear about those, that practice, as you say, you know, what's already emerging from communities, what's being strengthened, you know, at that grassroots level from the ground up through partnerships and the resources that come from, you know, building up connections across continents and supporting, you know, fair wages and that just transition as well to, you know, a more gender equal and inclusive society. So, you know, that being said, if we've got in those contexts, if there's the practice and there's the resources, then at policy level, you mentioned, you know, do we need just one more convention? And thinking ahead to later this year, I think that's the big question, isn't it? Will COP26 make the difference that it needs to make? I get the sense from civil society groups that people are rather disillusioned and not actually that hopeful. But there is the sense that if we keep having that joined up working with strong partnerships, then there could be a galvanizing civil society force, which might even be an alternative COP, because who knows, in the virtual space, you know, will there be that, you know, possibility for dissent, that possibility for protest, that possibility to really pressure governments and officials? So we don't really know what it's going to look like. But what do you think in this kind of critical year for climate action, what will COP26 bring us? And what differences can we expect given the circumstances of the pandemic? Also keen to hear from you, Isadora, about your experience in Madrid, which at the time was, you know, really quite a very dramatic way to experience the conference. So so maybe you can tell us a bit about that and then reflect on how that will feed into this year.
Yes. So in the context of the climate negotiations, which is already highly unaccessible space for groups, especially really local groups from civil society to attend. And so we civil society, normally when we can attend, we are observers of the process only. We can participate sometimes in giving some interventions, but we don't participate in the negotiations per se. These are the countries' delegates which do the main decisions. Of course, we can do advocacy, we can talk to them, but they are observers to the process. And by accompanying the process in the last, 3 years of work, I have been not only myself, but also the people who are part of the constituencies which I was in, the Women and Gender constituency. They were all saying, we could see that the space for civil society to be present and really active the way that civil society is supposed to do in, you know, democratic spaces, or what you would expect from a multilateral space led by the UN, is that those spaces were more and more shrinking and more being observed closely by, you know, by the organizers or even by some states. Like we would see in the last years, really close retaliations to, sometimes press conferences that people from our group from, I don't know, countries where the governments are pretty much right wing or far right wing, where they would intimidate in those spaces of the UN already directly the people in our constituencies. So those kind of things. So there were a lot of protests that we tried to make back then, also as a response for a lot of capture by corporate, by the corporate power, by, you know, big industries taking over that space. Of course, they have more resources, so they're much more present than, you know, NGOs or then social movements in those spaces for advocate for their interests. So corporate capture of the UNFCCC of the climate space in the last years. And the more we try to also like fight against it as civil society, as climate just civil society groups, and we found a lot of backlash, especially in Madrid, from the organizers or from security, from the UN. So this was very already incredibly shocking and traumatizing for a lot of us, especially people who face those kind of, you know, restrictions and violence in their own lands, in their own countries already. So it was very triggering, the last conference, for many people, and very traumatizing, I would say. And now in the context of the pandemic, so we were observing already a lot of, you know, the space was being restricted. Many voices were really being observed and cut whenever we would say something that would, So all of what I said before, but this year, the issue that, okay, the safety issues because of the pandemic, they kind of also, they put in disadvantage much more the civil society groups, which would be attending those conferences, because we see that that could be a tendency that the organizers would be limiting the conferences to a certain, you know, threshold for those who are not really, you know, negotiating. So this could be something that can happen. And we already anticipate that the participation of civil society this year, if in person, would be much reduced because of the regulations, COVID regulations still. And also, and then I think the alternatives are always in, you know, those civil society led spaces, like you mentioned, like the ones which are being organized in by COP26 coalition and other local groups in Scotland. So I would say that.
Yeah, definitely. May, would you like to talk about your kind of what you think might be happening, what could happen, what differences we can expect this year, and also the place of civil society previously in the climate negotiations and this year?
I have been very much involved in the high level political forum, which is the place where we discuss SDG and LESS and COPs, because that's where my work lies, much more in the systems change or systems thinking for systems change. So I haven't been to COPs recently. The last one was the Paris one. So I tend to go to those who are the milestones. So I was in the Copenhagen one and then in Paris one. And then I have some of my colleagues that are tend to, particularly those who are from the Global Ecovillage Network, they keep a pulse for the COPs. So I don't have too much of a hope. But definitely we have put together with many of our partners lots of proposals for events and debates. And one of them that I thought would be very interesting if we are able to be accepted is is one regarding women's voices to produce. Women that have been, you know, impacted by climate change, and they will be speaking or bringing their voice, amplifying their voice to their produce, which means bringing turmeric from India, honey from Zambia, some amazing crafts from the Satere Mawe women from at the outskirts of Manaus, and then soaps from Canberra, and many other produce that we are involved, but that the produce tell a story of women that are really, really engage into this social, ecologic, economic redesign, responding to erratic monsoons, to desertification. For instance, one of the regions that we work, the Minister of Agriculture is the monsoon. If the monsoon comes earlier or later, everything is disrupted. And some of these communities, they don't really understand why those weather patterns that they have worked for millennia have been disrupted. So it's like a whole conversation in into understanding what climate change and how are we going to be adapting, because it's a question much more of adaptation to climate change. So I guess COP, from my perspective, if it happens in the sense of face-to-face meetings, we would like to open the space for the voices of the women that we've been working with in 55 countries could come through their produce that symbolize their resilience and ability to adapt to the changes in climate.
Thinking about that imperative need to tell a story and to tell often different stories, we are certainly living in a moment of disrupted narratives. You know, as you say, the life ways and the ways of living on the land are fundamentally changing for communities across the world. And I think that it's really interesting to think of visioning for an alternative future, which ultimately is what COP should be about. Who knows if it will be, but it is about, you know, how do we continue to live within our planetary boundaries? How do we think about ways in which we can change our behavior and that we can develop that policy which will support it? So telling different stories, you know, adapting to our circumstances with that ability to change our kind of creative system of the way in which we live and the way in which we think is definitely crucial in this moment. So I think that we're kind of wrapping up and coming to the end of a really, really exciting conversation surrounding participation, representation, change, creativity, and transition. Connected to all of those themes is this kind of running idea, an umbrella idea, which we must be implementing and which both of you are implementing in your work and your projects of regeneration. I mentioned earlier that I recently took a Gaia education course on ecological design. So it really resonated with me what you said about the SDGs being a framework for how we are redesigning human lives in our communities. That change is already happening. It's a framework to think about it. So regeneration is a way in which design is also changing, that perhaps sustainability, as you said earlier, May, is something that people have kind of cottoned on to that idea. And now we think, okay, how can we add more? How can we add more health and well-being to a world that is depleting in those resources of health and well-being? I was really interested in the ecological design course, that sort of dilemma or difference between sustainability and regeneration was very much addressed, that regeneration adds something new and improved to the earth and ecosystem, and it also heals those links that we are often finding more and more fragile and destroyed. So can you tell us about what regenerative and regeneration means to you? And maybe also to finish up from you both, I'd love to hear an idea or a vision of what a regenerative future looks like, and one in which we can see gender and climate justice successfully implemented.
Well, I would say that regeneration as an applied concept has evolved over time, and we don't have time right now to talk about, but definitely in the 60s, regeneration was very much around revitalization of particularly of the urban fabric, by, you know, building post-war or developing post-war housing sites. And then in the 70s and 80s, regeneration was something that was taken over by neoliberalism. And then it keeps evolving. And then at the threshold of this millennium, we start bringing, you know, Regenesis and the other think tanks really talking about regenerative development as grounded in this deep understanding of the integral and interdependent nature of living systems, both social systems and biotic systems. It's not only ecosystems regeneration, but also it's not only urban fabric regeneration. It's humans and ecosystems at the same time. So for regenerative designers, it's not enough to aspire to mitigate the effects of human activity in the planet. Our role is to determine which aspects of the living systems to work in order to realize the greatest systemic potential. So that's basically what regenerative designers are aspiring. So you work very much with a place, is a place-based, and then from the place you go to potential, where you look at the tools, and it's a whole process of conversation and dialogue between human and natural systems. And that's very much needed right now.
Amazing. I am really amazed by what May just said. And I don't know, I would say that for me, what it would mean is really to generate again what colonial systems have destroyed. So basically, you know, indigenous knowledges and also knowledges from ancestral knowledges that, you know, communities which are today really marginalized. A lot of knowledge also from, you know, women organizing together, how like bringing them to life again or generating, you know, them again in our systems, in our even if it's within the system that we have. So we don't need to dismantle the whole system to regenerate it. We have to start doing it as soon as possible and now, and we're already late. So I think that's what I would see as a regenerative present or future, you know. Something which is really paying the tribute and also honoring all the knowledges that we have been systematically erasing throughout the last centuries. And so, and also, how do you say, but like, you know, paying the right tribute and giving justice back to it. So promoting justice to those systems. I thank you very much for the opportunity. And I hope that I learned a lot with both of you today.
Yes, I could definitely say the same. It's a pleasure to chat with you both about these themes, and I feel as though we could speak all evening. As you've both said, there's many more themes to cover within the large and pressing general theme of gender and climate justice, but you are both an inspiration in the work that you're doing, and thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you for inviting us.